Welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which hopes to inform America on what's going on and make America think again. We know that what goes on in the shadows is what makes politics go around. So we're here tonight, and we're lucky enough to have with us, as usual, Liberty Jones and Congressman Tom Davis. Retired congressman, Republican congressman from Virginia, a great friend who's been on the show before, and we're so lucky to have him again. I would give you his resume, but it's too long. He was a member for 13 years. I'll briefly tell you that Congressman Davis represented the 11th Congressional District of Virginia. And he served on the Committee of Oversight and Government Reform from 2003 to 2007, where he was on a number of high-profile investigations. He was chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee from 1999 to 2002. And when he joined Congress, he was the first freshman representative in 50 years to hold a subcommittee chairmanship, taking the gavel to the subcommittee on the District of Columbia. And the District of Columbia never had a better friend. He was the inventor and co-sponsor and introducer of the D.C. Voting Rights Act that would have given the District of Columbia their first vote in the House of Representatives in 200 years. And thank you for your dedicated service, Congressman. Welcome, Liberty Jones, and welcome, Congressman Davis. We're so happy to have you tonight.
Michael, let me just add to the resume. I did leave Congress undefeated and unindicted, something I'm very proud of.
And, are you sure it's unindicted?
Yeah.
Wait, I'm from New Jersey. We don't take any pride in unindicted. You know that. Now that you said that, I have to tell you, Congressman, I was in Las Vegas having dinner with my wife last year, and our waiter said to me, "Oh, you're a senator from Washington." I said, "Yeah," because my father was the mayor of Jersey City, New Jersey. I said, "Oh, well, I'm from New Jersey." He said, "Well, he went to jail." He said, "But he didn't do anything wrong. He just stole some money from the government." Like maybe that was part of the job description. I just thought that I could. But my
part of
wife
the culture.
And I couldn't.
Yeah, part of the
my
culture.
Wife and well, both of us are from New Jersey, so we got it. So let me start before I let my brilliant associate ask you a question. Let me start with 33 days of shutdown in the federal government. You represented Virginia. You represented many, many people that work for the federal government. I'm sure you still have many friends that work in the federal government. Who's making the big mistake here? The Republicans? Or the Democrats?
Michael, you are they making a gut? You ask your question: is it a political mistake or a governance mistake? From a government,
Is it a political mistake?
Well, I think the Democratic decision to not just continue on with a continuing resolution, a clean CR. In other words, just keep spending the way we've been doing until we reach an agreement. This has been the way Congress has operated for 40 years. What the rule is. You've had people from time to time try to add things to it, but eventually that's the de facto default. Is we'll extend the government at the current rate of spending until we get the appropriation bills passed. And there are 12 of them, and none of them were passed this year. And by the way, that's nothing new. That's de rigueur at this point. The last time Congress passed all the appropriation bills on time was in 1996. For FY97, and we only did it then because we'd shut the government down twice the year before, and I think we were doing a penance. It's also going into an election. So this time, the Democrats, who 13 straight times have voted to extend this under Biden, and one decided, our bases mad at us last time for caving in to a CR. We need to put up a fight. And so they put up a fight, and they picked a pretty good subject for them, and that's healthcare. Although when you peel this back, these are basically subsidies that apply to maybe 4 or 5% of the population that were put on temporarily that Democrats now want to make permanent. But it's a great talking point for them. I think initially, Republicans got more blame on this simply because President Trump has a very He's held in low esteem by most federal employees after Doge and everything else. And I think they were inclined to just blame the other side. But the longer this has gone on, I think there's just an impatience with both sides saying, why are we doing this at this point? We've got air traffic controllers not being paid. We've got ICE people not being paid. We've got food pantries and so on that are having to feed some of these workers that are not at the higher levels. And it's kind of, for those of us who've been around, guys, grow up. Let's not hold the federal workers hostage to your other petty disputes over health care. By the way, these things don't run out till the end of the year. This is November. There's still plenty of time to discuss that. But anyway, that's where it is. And we'll see. The only thing I'd add is, Mike, I went through a number of these because I represented over 50,000 federal employees. And I remember Newt Gingrich coming to me at one point saying, we need your vote. And I said, Newt, let me just explain something to you. If you're from Kansas, you represent wheat farmers. If you're from Fairfax County, you represent federal employees. You're going to have to look somewhere else. These are the people that are relying on me. And I still feel that way. And at this point, as I call it, I mean, this is the Democrats could have ended this very easily. They didn't have to make the fight at this point. But because politics is so oriented toward your political base and primaries, which is what elects, 80% of these, 85% of these members, they had to put up a fight. And I think they picked a decent fight in terms of, voters don't understand the specifics. So we'll see. My guess is that next year at this time, nobody's going to remember, but we'll see.
Well, and let me just follow up with, wouldn't it push the Republicans? Wouldn't it call the Republicans' hand? Because the Republicans are saying, just do the CR, do the CR, and we'll sit down and talk. So if we did this continuing resolution, if Democrats did the continuing resolution and the Republicans refused to talk on health care, then it will really put them in the hot seat, would it
Yeah, and you
not?
get it, and you get another bite at the end of the year because the CR is only for a period of time. If at
Right,
that
we're a
point, then
short
you have the
period of
upper
time.
hand, of course. But look, the Schumer last time for the fiscal year, they did a CR for the fiscal year. That's very rare. So all of the appropriations details that the appropriators worked out basically thrown out the window. We did a continuing resolution for the year. And Schumer decided, he got enough Democrats to support the Republicans, and the government didn't shut down. And he just caught the devil from his base. He went to 15 points down in a head-to-head with AOC just in New York Senate primary. The Democratic base, just the one thing that unites them is Donald Trump. They do not like Donald Trump, and they want their representatives to put up a fight. And this is
Yes.
that fight. This is that fight. Unfortunately, the federal workers are the ones that are held hostage. They didn't do anything wrong here. But this is the place that they've chosen to make their fight. And look, we're in polarized times. Trump is not a bring us all together and let us reason together type of a leader. And this is what we've got.
Liberty, go ask a brilliant question.
My voice is so strained today. I'm so sorry about this. Thank you so much for coming on the show, by the way. It's such a pleasure to have you here. I really like the way you look at things, that this is, the politics of the situation, that hopefully people will not remember this in a year from now. However, I think that's exactly the problem, is that it seems like right now, when we see there's something wrong with what's going on, we're going about it very passively, being that, yes, people don't like who is in office because he's governing an entire Republican branch. He's doing more than just standing in his presidency. And I think even though maybe it won't be on the news and it won't be as polarized in a year, there are actually 42 million Americans who are benefiting from SNAP right now. And I think that they are going to remember when they had to lose trust in the systems put into place to help feed them. And to me, the role of the government and the role of politics is to help govern the people and not take away their right to something like nutrition when they have promised to help them just for performance of political polarization.
Well, Liberty, the answer to that is very simply, if the Democrats vote for a continuing resolution, everybody gets their SNAP benefits. The fact that they haven't voted for the continuing resolution is what stopped these SNAP benefits. It's not the administration. They're trying to put the onus on the administration. And they say one of two things. They say, well, you can pick or choose, and you can find a way within this to fund this, even though we haven't funded it for you. You can find the money to do this, as you've done for defense. Or they're secondly saying, or you can just break the Senate rules, break the filibuster, and have the Republicans enact there. So look, this is a pointless game. But traditionally, the easy way to do this is you pass a continuing resolution. And then this never been an issue before. So, everybody, nobody's wearing a white hat here. This is a political power struggle. And these poor people that are sitting there waiting for their food are the ones that get thrown under the bus, along with federal employees. But it's not like anybody here is looking out for them. These folks are, they're victims of this, if you will. They're the hostages on this case until somebody wheels. Let me add one other thing. There's no way the Republicans are going to give the Democrats what they want on health care. They may give them a piece of it. They may decide, in fact, I think they offered, we'll do this, some Republicans did, we'll offer to extend this for a year. And Hakeem Jeffries, at least to one member, said, well, no, that's not enough. So I think they're just looking for a fight here rather than a solution. And once the performance is over, maybe we can go by. But in the meantime, these people are just getting hurt. And both parties have kind of put them to the side at this point for larger points. But I don't think you can realistically point to one side or the other at this point. If there's a lot of problems here on both sides. But
Can I ask, you, excuse me, Liberty, can I just ask you, does it, the president can end this as well? Can he not? He could, they could fund SNAP. They could, right? They could. So are the Republicans holding it
Well,
hostage?
there is that is a matter of debate, because you do have something called the Anti-Deficiency Act, and if you start spending money that hasn't been appropriated, now there is some money probably available for SNAP that he could, and the argument is he's found some money to pay defense employees. Why can't he find it for SNAP? And you can get into that on anything. So that's trying to put the onus, but I don't fault the president on this. I just fault the Congress for not passing a continuing resolution and not appropriating the money for SNAP. They haven't done that. And I understand the finger pointing. And look, Donald Trump is a is we and it's a polarized country, but he's a polarizing figure, and people are going to believe him or not believe him, and view it accordingly. My argument on this, Michael, is that, don't we care about governance? Is this do we care about the folks, or are we just trying to make our political points here? And the real problem in this country is that for 85% of these members, the only political race that matters is their primary election. November is just a constitutional formality. And by the way, this is going to get worse by the time we go through these gerrymandering wars in Texas and California and all these other places. The voters are just out of the equation in November. So the default is I got to please my primary voters. And I will tell you, Republican primary voters are very happy with the way things are and the way Donald Trump is going. And Democratic primary voters are equally unhappy with the way things, and they want to fight. And there's very little middle left in this country to try to put things together that gets a benefit of compromise.
I'm sorry, Liberty, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Liberty.
I completely agree with you that at the end of the day, that's the problem, that there are two very distinct sides. Divide and conquer, united we survive, divided we fall. I really agree with that. However, it seems like there is a lot of shifting blame in place. And do you really believe that the only way to get rid of this budget impasse is for the Democrats to comply and sign over to what is being expected from them?
Well, I think the way you pass it, look, the House, just understand the makeup of the House, right? It's very closely partisan divided, right? And the House did the only thing, given the current alignments, and that's a small Republican majority, the only thing they could do, and that is pass a continuing resolution. And they really had to kick some people to get them to vote for that. And they got that out, and they pushed it out, and they pushed it over to the Senate. The Senate now, it's up to them. They can respond by adopting that, or they can come, you can get 60 votes together to come back and say, well, we'll do a CR, but we want to do two or three other things and add that and ping it back to the House. But the House can't do anything else. They're just the way the alignments are. I mean, theoretically they can, but the practicality is they can't do anything else. And they're waiting for the Senate. And at this point, the Senate, you have three Democrats that have voted with Republicans on this, and one Republican, Rand Paul, who will never vote for anything. But you've got to muster 60 votes together under their rules, the cloture rules, the filibuster rules, and they can't seem to get to 60 on anything, and that is the problem. But the House has done what it can do. Now, it's a bad look when Johnson doesn't call the Republicans in the House back into town. There's a lot of finger pointing about why he won't do that and the like. And you've got now, after Tuesday, you're going to have two Democratic members that are elected in vacant seats that are going to be waiting to take their seats. I think that puts more pressure on him. But aside from the performance, the practicality is the Senate's got to come up with something. And right now, they can't seem to come together on anything. And the easiest thing would be to say, all right, we're going to accept the House version, which is just until November 21. We're going to take you at your word, and we're going to negotiate these other things, and we'll revisit this November 21. But in the meantime, you've lost 30-plus days. People have lost their SNAP benefits. We're going to lose other benefits, too. Military people aren't getting paid, and that's the price you pay for performance politics.
Well, let me ask you, it's tied up in the Senate, what about the nuclear option? What about, as somebody that's fought for DC statehood for 18
Right.
years, it does my heart good a little
Yeah.
bit to hear the press secretary say they want to make DC a state. They want to make Puerto Rico a state because that's one of our big problems, right, Congressman, that most people don't
Right. Yeah.
understand that we don't have the same rights. But what do you think? Is that a realistic
No,
option?
it's
No.
not for Republicans. Look,
Yeah.
you traditionally, I mean, and the reason for that, Michael, is that it looks great when you're in the majority, but as soon as
Right.
you lose the majority, you're going to rue the day. And I'll just give you an example. The Democrats, at one point under Obama, had a majority of the Senate, but they didn't have 60 votes. And President Obama couldn't get his appointees through because the Republicans were blocking judges. They blocked a Supreme Court judge, right? But they were blocking judges when they had a majority. They were blocking judges. They were blocking people to go to regulatory commissions. They were blocking undersecretaries and the like. And finally, Harry Reid said, "Heck with this. I'm going to revoke the nuclear option. And now, for now on, for appointments outside of the Supreme Court, for every appointment, we're going to make it 60 votes. I mean, we're going to make it 50 votes. We're going to take away the
Right.
60 vote rule." And it didn't apply to legislation. He kind of carved that piece out. Well, that was fine. And then the Republicans take the presidency under Trump, and they want to get a Supreme Court nominee through, and they can't get 60 votes to get a Supreme Court nominee through. And they said, "Well, look, you did it for every other judgeship. We're going to do it for the Supreme Court." And so it's being nibbled away at this point. And it has not gone the legislative route because at that point, I think you're going to see the full transference of American balance of power structure into a parliamentary behavior. The problem is our structure of government is not a parliamentary structure. It's a balance of power structure. But we're behaving like it's parliamentary. And that would kind of be the last straw if you break up the 60 vote rule in the Senate. The problem for that is I'll just issue Michael, what could the Republicans do under Donald Trump in the next year and a half or in the next year if you do away with that? There's a lot of things they can do that you're not going to like that they can move through on 50 votes. And you may take the Senate at some point, but in the meantime, you have this bulwark right now that some of the worst instincts of one party rule are stymied because you have to try to reach some kind of bipartisan consensus. We've lost the ability to do that in this country. We're not talking to each other. We're talking at each other. We don't even get the same information. We watch different TV shows. We get different podcasts, right? We get different algorithms feed what we hear every day. And this is very, very divided. There's no shared truths anymore. Just that makes it really hard to govern. And so I don't even know. Look, I was up there a long time and I was in the leadership and a committee. I don't even know what the truth is sometimes. You get it, but both sides have been wrong so often. You really have to look behind the curtain sometimes to figure out what's going on.
Is the Supreme Court is currently hearing arguments about the president's ability to issue these blanket tariffs
Right.
and invoke his power to do that. And I heard the Cato Institute, which surprised me today, come out and say on Meet the Press that there, or I'm sorry, on CNN, that they're supporting the argument that the president does not have the power to do this under right. his under. So is the bloom coming off the rose?
No. Look, what you've got with Donald Trump, and I just walk back to his coalition, right? He won the Republican nomination, and he's much he's not really as conservative as he is kind of populist. You know, he's got his own brand, right? This Make America Great brand. When I was in the House, if you wanted to get on the Ways and Means Committee, you had to be a free trader. You had to take that free trader vow. I was a free trader. I certainly was for NAFTA. I voted for all of these trade agreements. My economics are very conservative. And then President Trump comes along and all of a sudden he wants tariff everything, which is Democrats traditionally were for tariffs. They were the ones who, because their labor union base, were demanding tariffs to protect them. We almost kind of switched positions on this, on a personal basis. I'm looking at the presidency. If he can do tariffs unilaterally and declare an emergency on anything, what good is Congress anymore? Where do you develop consensus? On the other hand, you look at the president's position is if I wait for Congress, nothing happens. That's why both Obama with DACA, Biden on student loans, and they all got overruled along the way, but they were just stymied by the inability of Congress to come together and act on things. And so you've seen an erosion of congressional power because Congress doesn't act as an independent body anymore. The minority party no longer considers themselves a minority shareholder. They're just the opposition party. And the president's party is just an appendage of the executive branch. It's kind of, it wasn't like this 25, 30 years ago. And I don't think the founders envisioned it this way, but that's what it's become. And it results from these single party districts where for just 85% of these members, the only race that counts is primary. So that's who you cater to, right? Primary voters don't reward compromise. They punish it. Ask Chuck Schumer, right? He voted to keep the government open last time, and he paid a huge price among New York primary Democratic voters. People get different information. Republicans get completely different information than Democrats. We say people don't tune in for information. They tune in for affirmation. They go to Absolutely. Sites that basically reaffirm their worldviews. And by the way, the people that feed them do this because it's their business. If they don't, Fox News at one point acknowledged Donald Trump might have lost the election in 2020, and they were losing tens of thousands of viewers to Newsmax. They had to recalibrate. The Washington Post decides not to endorse for president. They lose hundreds of thousands of online subscribers. So these are business models. It's not news. And then I just finally say, campaign finance reform, what a joke. I was a floor manager against it. At the time, we said, look, where do you think this money's going to go? I know you're taking this evil, soft money away from the parties and candidates, but this money's not going to leave the system. You still have some underlying cases, Buckley versus Valeo and the like. And so what's happened is the money has moved away from the political parties and candidates out to these independent political action committees that are nothing but enforcement mechanisms for the right and the left in primaries. So if you step outside your party box in a single party district, you get ambushed and there's no cavalry. So the combination of these things has just made politicians who want to have some kind of future in the business, it's made it hard for them to follow their instincts at this point, and they've got to stay in that kind of in that party box or get punished.
Liberty, how do you feel?
I feel so many ways. You know, I will say I really appreciate your perspective. It's really refreshing. A lot of times it's really hard to have a fluid conversation like this. And, you know, I really agree with you that it's what my generation calls it is clickbait politics.
Yeah.
People saying what others want to hear for a reason. And, you know, obviously technology and social media and fake news and all of those things are making it a lot worse. But me personally, I feel very sick and tired of just sitting here and watching it unravel. This is a problem that is only getting worse. It's been happening for, you said it yourself, maybe 20 years. And my question is, you know, you guys have a lot of experience with this. When do you think that governing for optics began and governing for outcomes stopped? And I ask this because I want to understand, how can we unravel this now? We've seen what's going on, you know, we've acknowledged the problem. We understand that we need to unite. We understand that we need to reach We want the same things. We want a better America. We want to go about it differently. And it's ruining people's lives. It's killing people at this point. So what can we do to go back to a system of governance and not a system of power plays?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I'll just give you a perspective as somebody who was, I never lost an election in out here in Northern Virginia. But went through a lot of elections. I went through 11 elections, none of them, by the way, in Republican territory. It was always in kind of a tough, either a swing district or hostile by the voting patterns. But it taught me something very early, just for survival, is you need to listen to the other side, because they played a role in sending. I couldn't just play to Republicans. I had to play to everybody and listen to everybody, because I had a very competitive seat to kind of hold it. So before you look at me as some saint or something, it's altruistic. It was survival for me. Most members, it's not survival anymore. Their survival is staying in that party base. All right. Having said that, Liberty, we built a great civilization. I mean, even the poorest Americans today have better health care than kings did a century ago. I mean, the advances in technology, you get clean water, hot showers, food. I mean, we've built a great civilization. And before we start tearing it down, I think we need to understand, let's understand how we got here and why half the world wants to come here. We don't have people leaving here. We got people want to come here because they don't find it other places. So let's just start with that. And then let's acknowledge that maybe we're only operating at 20% efficiency in terms of what we could become. That's what's so frustrating to me. And I know that this Mandami in New York, he's getting a lot. Well, you know what? He struck a responsive chord. He's very smart. He's very articulate. I've watched him. I don't happen to agree with his answers, but he's put his finger on a problem that the mainstream political actors have not put on. Donald Trump did the same thing when he ran. He did reality television for a decade, and he was talking to a vast swath of Americans that everybody else was ignoring. And he connected with them in a way that a lot of us, I represent a very elite district out in Northern Virginia. I wasn't hearing the kind of complaints from my folks that Donald Trump was getting in rural America in particular. In some of these places that were depressed and losing jobs. I was in an area, I thought the highest income district in the country. So Trump understood this because he did reality TV. Liberty, I don't watch reality TV. I am proud to say that. That stuff, to me, is just junk. I did watch, Michael, I watched Jersey Shore once just to see what the big hullabaloo about Snooki was. And I said, people watch this stuff? But a lot of people do. They have a different value structure, different entertainment stuff. And so Trump understood this, and he struck because mainstream politicians, Republicans and Democrats, were not addressing it. Mandami is very much the same thing. He has struck a chord with a lot of people that are saying to the power structures to be, we don't like it. And you're saying the same thing here. You're saying, look, politics isn't working right now. These guys are just pointing fingers with each other. You got people going hungry. You got federal workers not being paid that are on the job. And eventually, to answer your question, it's going to come from voters. And voters will send that message. V.O. Key was one of the great political scientists of the 20th century. And he wrote in his book, Public Opinion, he opined. He said, voters aren't stupid. He said, they're just not informed. He says, but they know when the shoe is pinching and it's time to get a new pair of shoes. And I think we're seeing with both the Trump phenomena, the Mandami, when the shoe is pinching, politicians answer the call at this point. And there ought to be a wake up that when you start shutting down the government for some of these things that really ought to be solvable. I mean, we're counting on government to keep the lights on, and here they can't keep the lights on. You're going to get a reaction sometimes that you don't like. And it's not just America. You look at the AfD in Germany right now. You look at the Reform Party in the UK. This is going globally. As everybody else is kind of playing politics and elitist, and we're forgetting about results. So your generation may have to change it. I don't want to get too screwed up because my economics are pretty right of center. But I'm just telling you, that's what you get when politicians can't deliver.
And when did it start? I think it started when Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton went at it. And it's been going on ever since. You know, I mean, if you look at history, and this may be a problem with young people sometimes, they don't have that perspective. But, you know, Andrew Jack, they said nasty things about Andrew Jackson's wife. They said, you know, Dolly Madison was attacked in the press. So it's been going on ever since two people got together
democracy.
And ran against
each
other.
Absolutely.
Right, it is. It's democracy. But
And
let
look,
me ask you, since you bring up European countries, are we headed towards the same kind of problems that multi-party countries have? I always thought the Italians were the great democracy because they let everybody run the country for a couple of weeks. Are we going to have that same problem in the United States as we kind of segregate into these small interest groups instead of a broader Democrat and Republican? And are the beneficiaries of this deadlock independents? Do both parties lose from not being able to get along?
Well, I think they both do. And I think right now the Republicans' biggest fear in 2016 was that Donald Trump would pick up and run as an independent, and he'd take half the Republican base with him at that point, and they'd be neutered. You know what I mean? Democrats have the same problem. Bernie Sanders decides the Democrats aren't doing what they need to do. He'll just pick up. He'll take half the Democratic Party with him at this point. So it moved the Democratic Party left. It moved the Republican Party, I don't want to say right, but it's certainly in a more populist pose to try to absorb this within a two-party framework, which has been our tradition. Now, Michael, in D.C., they've gone to ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting, at the end of the day, ranked choice voting, you're going to get a proliferation of parties. That just encourages third and fourth parties, right? Because why not, and pile on and be part of the coalition and cut your deals. But look, we've always been fragmented, and parties are coalitions. They're very dissonant sometimes. I would walk in a room with a group of Republicans, and there's a group of them you can't stand and you don't agree with on something. But, at the end of the day, that party advanced the th issues that were most important to me better than the Democratic Party. And that's how you make your choice. Party
And that
coalitions they are constantly mutating. They're not stagnant. They are always changing at this point. And we're seeing that today. I mean, the Republican base has migrated from the country club to the country. You've traded in Fairfax County for West Virginia when you take a look at it, literally.
And can I ask you about how that dynamic's changed? Because, my first decent job, I've been working full time since I was 14, and my first decent job was as a Teamster. And I was shocked to see the head of the Teamsters Union speak at the Republican convention for Donald Trump. I don't think a Teamsters ever even a president has ever even attended the Republican convention. So how when did working class people and union people and people like that become Republicans or become conservatives? What was that shift?
Well, I think it's a number of things. Number one, I think is the economic policies of the Democrats, and you can go back a generation. They saw that the hollowing out of industrial America in Midwestern towns because of some of the trade issues and the like. Secondly, the emphasis of the parties on cultural issues, where all of a sudden guns and abortion and gay rights became more important in how people voted than other things, didn't always identify with the working class. Michael, you work with Teamsters. Teamsters have a different definition of what a man and a woman is than maybe Democratic elitists. You know what I'm saying? So the
Yes, I
party just
do.
kind of lost that connection. And when the economics went south for them, I'll tell you what really hurt this last time was inflation. I make a lot of money. I didn't. So I come from a mother. I had a single mother of five kids when I grew up. But I've been pretty successful since I left Congress. I didn't feel inflation, right? I was in the stock market. I was making money. I may pay a little more at the grocery store. My salary's going. But if you weren't in the stock market and you didn't own a home and you didn't own a car, you couldn't get in the game. And by the way, your wages were falling behind, behind, and behind. Nobody realized how bad inflation was because we hadn't seen it since Jimmy Carter. And that really affects people at the lower end of the economic scale. And they finally, when with Biden and Harris, they're talking about Bidenomics, and they're saying, "What are you talking about?" And Donald Trump, again, talked directly to these people. You talk about West Virginia, when you start talking about climate change and blaming coal miners, you're just striking right at the heart of their identity. So you have all of these things that have churned. West Virginia's gone from one of the most Democratic states in the Union a generation ago to probably the second most Republican state in the Union today. There are only two Democrats in the state Senate out of 40. I mean, that's how quickly this has changed. And the Democratic Party, and you can see a little bit of it in DC. I'm watching DC now, Michael, as I watch the in-migration, right, of the yuppie class into DC and on the class like that. And you're seeing a little rebellion in Anacostia and something like, what do we have in common with these people? They're talking about things that are kind of alien to us. So coalitions change over time and leadership changes. And the Democratic Party, in my opinion, they're at an all-time low in the polling right now. But they are united on one thing. They are the anti-Trump party, much like the Whigs were the anti-Andrew Jackson party, right? They're going to have this conversation over the next 2 years over who's going to lead this party. My judgment is I saw what happened to the Republican Party after Bush. Bush presided over two wars that went sideways on him, Iraq and Afghanistan, and an economic meltdown with the subprimes at the end of his term. And the Republican Party was a shell of itself after Bush left in 2008 and Obama wins. And we say power abhors a vacuum. The Tea Party came in and they just filled that void right away. And they moved the Republican Party like 10 points to the right. Right now, after Biden, it's hard for Democrats. I don't hear a lot of Democrats saying, well, I'm really proud of Joe Biden. He was, great. The Democratic Party is having this conversation now. What's the post-Biden party? They're kind of down in the dumps. Their brand is. And look, you're getting the mandamis and the Democratic Socialists and the progressive wing are rushing in to fill that vacuum. And we're going to see how it's handled. The Democratic Party is going to have that conversation. It's easy to be against Trump. I think that probably gets them through the midterms in terms of where they want to go. But when you're running presidential elections, Trump won't be on the ballot next time. Then it becomes a choice election and it becomes a very different dynamic. But for now, I think they're coasting on just being against Trump, and that may be enough to get him the House in the midterms.
Well, and that's cyclical, right? I worked for Jimmy Carter, and I could say the same things that you just said after Carter when we had Mondale and we had,
Right, exactly.
the people,
And
Dukakis.
Carter was a reaction to McGovern.
Yeah, it was. Liberty, save these two old men.
Okay.
Ask something brilliant.
Well, I have a lot to say.
I know you do.
First, I'd like to defend the younger generations. Because I know that we're raised under the political unicorn of Obama and that politics are centered around divide. That's how we properly decipher what needs to be implemented by combating each other and by understanding what is more valuable to society. However, I believe that America has been the world's greatest superpower because of their morality, regardless of this political divide that has been in place for, as you both said, a very long time. If anything, I think that divide even makes us stronger because it helps to keep us in check. And that's exactly my problem, is that what you mentioned, what both of you mentioned, the entire world is heading down a similar path right now. And this divide communally is only escalating. I think in part it is somewhat of a reaction to the world's greatest superpower. I come from a foreign family. That's how we viewed the United States. When a country so powerful acts in those ways, I think it is inspirational to the rest of the world. You said it yourself, everybody leaves their countries to join the United States for a reason, and so they want to understand how to employ that into their own situations. I want to add a side note that in Brazil last week, there was a massacre that went down in the books of history in South American police massacres that 130 low-class citizens of a favela were killed by the police. So this abuse of power and people being able to sit there and not know what to do is inspiring the world. And to me, this is not just about political bickering. For me, it's about a loss of morality. And I want to see the world embrace this compassion again. Do you think that America has lost its moral compass or just the ability to express morality through policy? That's the problem for me. I don't care that they're having these divides. I think it is a systemic grounding issue. My question to you is, when morality disappears from the government, what fills the void? Ideology, money, fear? What does a moral superpower look like in the 21st century? How can we get to that, because this is systemic. It is rooted into people's attitude. Is this idea even still achievable? And how is it possible to separate moral leadership from political power when one inevitably corrupts the other? Those are my questions.
Yeah,
I'm
well, that's
very
easy enough, right?
Go
Yeah,
ahead.
exactly. I mean, first of all, you've got to remember there is within this country, we have a lot of different value structures. Politics tries to sort those out, but we have a lot of people that feel very differently about some very, very important issues that you could call moral issues. I like to think we have the moral high ground because we are at our heart a democracy. We try to treat everybody equally. Everybody's got access to the ballot box at the end of the day. We have there's a lot of criticism about the number of billionaires and rich people. I'll give you a simple fact. The question you used to ask is, what percent of the population are the top 10% earners? And of course, the answer should be 10%, right? It's really 50% because that top 10% earners, 50% of families enter that at some point during their careers, but then they retire and a new group comes in. We still are a country of upward mobility and opportunity. And I think that's what makes us very, very different from some of the European areas. If you look at the people who've been successful in this country, a lot of immigrants who come here with nothing, but we provide an economic system where they can prosper and grow and have the tools that if you work hard and make good decisions that you can move ahead. And I think that gives us a level, in my judgment, of moral superiority that most of these other countries don't have. Now, do we argue over that? Do we fight over? Absolutely. That's part of a democracy, right? We come from different faiths, different religions, and the like. But as long as we allow that innovation spirit to exist in that upward mobility, I think we're going to be okay. Liberty, I was in college. I went to a little college in Massachusetts called Amherst in the height of the anti-war movement. And I mean, we were much more divided. Wouldn't you say, Michael, during the Vietnam War than now? I
Yeah.
mean,
Oh, yeah.
it was really bad. We had the incursion to Cambodia, 4 students were killed at Kent State. We've been through this before. The way out of this, though, is the country at some point comes together through this divisiveness, and you get leaders who end up bringing us a little bit together. And we're kind of looking for that at this point, as we are polarized in our elections. I think leaders come on the scene that try to unite us, and people at some point decide enough fighting. But look, as long as America, I think, is the land of opportunity, I think that's our moral compass because most countries just don't offer that. We don't have knighthoods and the like in America.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, has that opportunity. Some may start out ahead because you're from a wealthier family or something like that, but by and large, anybody can make it in this country. You have that opportunity. I think our real challenge, Liberty, is that I don't think everybody understands that. I think some people think they don't have a chance, that they don't see the value of education, that they come from fractured homes where they're not preached the opportunity of America and they plead victimhood or something else. And that's the problem, is to bring that promise of America to everybody and let them be the best they can be. But as long as we have the tools to do that, I think we're going to maintain that.
Well, I think one of the advantages, maybe, that you and I have, Congressman, is that we both remember 1968, and we both remember how horrible things were in
Oh,
the
yeah.
1960s and 1970s. You know, I certainly, my first introduction to activism was protesting the Vietnam War. But let me ask you something, and I know this is an important liberty. You'll probably have a good follow-up question to this. Let me talk about ICE for a minute. My daughter is in Chicago, and she and I had a discussion earlier today. But one of the first protests I ever went to, I was in Lafayette Park, and the National Guard was surrounding the White House. And the National Guard was very much on edge because they had been there for a while. And we witnessed a handful of what appeared to be government people get out of a car, walk up to the front of Lafayette Park and throw bricks at the National Guard, then get back in the car and leave, which, of course, gave the National Guard the right to move on the protesters, which they did. Now, is that the same thing going on here? Is that why ICE is being so violent and aggressive
Well, Michael,
because
let
they
me
really want to start a fight?
no. Well, I don't know. Let me just give you my view of it, because I was,
Okay.
to me, one of the great frustrations of American politics is not having to found, get a decent immigration policy since Simpson-Mazzoli in
That's true.
1986. Where I think you want to be is we need a high wall and a wide gate. We're a country of immigrants. That's our strength that keeps us from becoming Europe. The pioneers in this country are today's immigrants. So, but I think they need to be vetted. We need to be generous with those numbers, but they need to go through the gate. And for so long, that was just ignored. Immigration policies ignored. People pulling across, not all of them pleasant people. For people that came over and established themselves and had kids and got jobs and stuff like that, they're technically in violation of the law. There's no statute of limitations on this, but it was well enough alone until you get some other people come over that aren't doing well, and now they're cracking down. And I think there's a lot of sympathy for some of the folks that came over and see them being arrested and who have established themselves versus people who are have committed crimes. But it's a very polarizing issue. It's hard to sometimes differentiate, is this good? But you know, the law is the law. And you can fault the administration, but it's really Congress's fault for not having come to grips with this issue years ago. I was a conferee when we tried to get the Senate and the House together. The solution's pretty easy. You got to seal the border and you give the people who have been here and have had jobs, and you give them some level of immunity on here so that they can prosper and grow and be safe and not have to be part of the underground economy. But, you know, sorting that out is just forces a lot of difficult political discussions where on the Republican side, they'd run after you and say, oh, he's for amnesty. And that's poison in a Republican primary. On the Democratic side, on the other hand, oh, they want to put up a wall. That's immoral. And so people just backed into their corners and we couldn't get an agreement on something that I think is pretty common sense. You want to seal border and you need to let people in. And you got to take care of the people that are here. You're not going to send them all back. But you could not have that conversation politically because primary voters didn't react to it that way. They looked at it from one side or the other.
But isn't it the oldest canard in politics, Congressman? I mean, one of my heroes, a benevolent rogue named Huey Long,
oh, yeah,
used to say, there's 100,000 Frenchmen in New Orleans and your house could burn down and your baby could drown. And not one of those Frenchmen would care. So hasn't that always been at the center of our politics to separate people on the basis of ethnicity, race, and immigration? Isn't that old?
There was a book, Liberty, when I was in school, we used to go, called Beyond the Melting Pot. It was by Samuel Glazer and Daniel Moynihan. Just talked about generally the first generation of immigrants kind of segregate themselves. You know, they set up, they live among each other. They have their own system of shops. I mean, the Bank of America, do you know what it was originally? It was the Bank of Italy. It was started in America because Italians couldn't get loans from other banks. Right. And then through acquisition, it grew into this. But it generally takes a generation or two for immigrants to kind of meld into the process. And we've had a lot of immigration recently into this country. And I think some people feel threatened by it. When you get the rapidity of change that we've had in society so quickly, for some people, it's not fast enough and they're at the point of the sphere. And come on, you got to go faster and faster. But there are people at the other end who feel their status threatened and they kind of dig in. As Burke opined on the revolution in France, revolutions don't occur when things are getting worse. Revolutions occur when things are getting better because of rising expectations. And I think given the rapidity of change that we've had in society at this point, it's up to political leadership to try to manage that. And at this point, everybody's going back to their corners. And from my perspective, very disappointing because we have so much potential. These immigrants offer so much potential coming here. It's our great strength. It's frustrating to see us operating at 20% capacity. That's all I can tell you. But it's for the reasons I talked about. It's these single party districts and media and everything else that just tend to keep us polarized.
Liberty, I know you have something to say on this issue. Go.
Well, I think that we study history so that it doesn't repeat itself. And that's exactly why I have such a big problem with this, because America has done this before. And America is the land of freedom and privilege. That's what makes it so beautiful. However, it's not, maybe on a global stance, it's doing better for other people in the world, but it's not acting like that. it's very disproportionately affecting a lot of minorities right now, like it has before in the past. And I don't think that there is no law that legalizes the killing of innocent migrants on a boat. I think this has gone beyond what's legal and what's okay. And at the same time, on an economic standpoint, GDP is composed of land, labor, and capital. The United States, you guys said it yourself, is a country made of immigrants. It was colonized. That means you don't have labor. You had to import all your labor. So I don't see the logistics behind this at all whatsoever. I don't think it's legal either. I think it's gone past the point of even political performance. And I want to understand what needs to be done to unravel this, to make Republicans feel like they have control over their population and to allow people to live.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I want to unpack it a little bit. Are you talking about migrants? Are you talking about these boats coming out
I'm
of
talking
Venezuela?
about illegal immigration right now and how we are abusing immigrants. I saw a video of an ICE officer, and this was a real video, although marketed to my liberal media, who duct taped an individual. What happened to handcuffs? I think we have gotten really passionate about the cause, and now it's becoming abusive. So what are we going to do about it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know anything about the individual and what the, what they had on them or anything else. I've done enough arrests as a lawyer and stuff to see it's never pleasant when somebody gets stopped and arrested. But you would agree, wouldn't you, Liberty, that we have a right to maintain our own border and decide who a country wants to let in and not, wouldn't
Of
you?
course, of
And
course.
the people that abuse that come at their own risk when they walk across without the appropriate papers. Now, a lot of these folks are here basically looking for asylum, and they kind of follow the rules to do that. They could have, because the administration was lax in having them do this through their own country, and they walked across the border, and it gets a little complicated from there. But we had an election on this issue, and Donald Trump won, and one of the big reasons he won was because people were just tired of seeing a porous border, and he's, for better or for worse, he stopped up that border at this point, and we're not getting a lot of illegal border crossings. And the question is, what do you do with the people that are here? And I think you can, there's certainly going to be instances up there where there's been some overreaction and the like. But I think they have every right. The government has a right to go after people that are here illegal and to make them, to haul them before an illegal process to decide what should happen. And I think, the visuals are very are tough on that, but nobody's shooting down migrants to mine. Oh, it's clearly illegal. It's a murder. You can't just do those kind of things. That may have happened in Brazil, but that doesn't happen here. But it's very
Wow.
emotional for a lot of these communities where you have a lot of people that have been part of the fabric of these communities for 20 years. It might have entered, without papers 20 years ago, and they've been good citizens. These are tough calls for the administration at this point. And there's obviously a lot of sympathy for those people.
Well, and all I got to say to that, Congressman, I just got to add that when you annihilate a bunch of people on a boat without due process and without charging them with anything, I think that it is going on here. I think what went on in Brazil is going on here. It's just not going on the same scale, maybe, but I
That's a
agree with you.
you raise a good point. I mean, I understand what your point is. So I was down in Colombia a lot, when I was chairman of the committee, because all that drug stuff came through my committee. And I was there as we went through Plan Colombia and trying to eradicate some of these drugs from coming into the United States. And at this point, you have some of these problems coming in south of the border. And I think the president, you don't have a cooperative government in Venezuela. And I think the president has been trying to send out a message to the cartels and everybody else that we're watching you. I don't know where this goes. It does raise a host of legal issues, Michael, that I think remain unanswered at this point. But I think presidents, and this goes to President Biden, who was struck down a number of times for some of the things he tried to do, get frustrated with Congress's inability to act. And so, as an executive, you tend to act. You tend to overact on some things, and the courts eventually strike you down, but they don't act quickly. But we'll see where all this goes at this point. We don't really have enough information to know who these people are. Nobody's asking them for IDs, and you hope nobody's pushing the wrong button. You know, President Obama at one point had an American citizen killed by a drone, and there was a lot of criticism on that without any due process. Presidents make tough to take to have to make tough decisions sometimes on that. But I think that'll come out. I don't know really enough about these particular situations to comment on them, except that they obviously raise some questions. But I don't think drug dealers get the due process on the high seas.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time here. Thank you so much for coming on again, Congressman Davis. We hope you'll come back on the show sometime. Let me tell you that as a kid that grew up in Newark, New Jersey, the message that's being sent here to the Venezuelans, in my humble opinion, are the same kind of messages the mafia used to send in my Italian neighborhood when they wanted to strike fear into the residents, and it worked very well. Liberty Jones, thank you for being here and asking all the right questions. Representative
Thanks,
Tom
Liberty.
Davis, thank you so
Thank
much
you.
for being on the show. I wish you continued success. Tonight, I'm going to take a moment of personal privilege to pick a song to play us out. It's Mrs. Brown's 34th anniversary. So this song is the song that we danced to at our wedding. Here's Chaka Khan. Through the fire. Thanks, guys. See you next week.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks,
Thank you.
Liberty.